can. But will you?
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
With IRN USA Radio News, I'm Larry Dickerson.
Usually scoffed at. An illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it is going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're looking at or listening to. They happen to be my views, and, hopefully they're going to be the views of our guest this evening. We haven't been able to get him yet, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about Paul Williams. Paul Williams is an investigative reporter. He has a PhD, but of course he predominantly spends his time studying various issues and then writing about them. He's written a number of books. He's actually, in the past, has worked very closely with government agencies, but in more recent years, as he's begun to probe into what's really going on and come up with some very, very disturbing findings, why he is sort of persona non grata with many of the government agencies, because he's looked into the background of this world terrorist movement and found that many times this whole world terrorist movement, including the terrorist movement in the United States, has been largely funded or tolerated or helped by people at the highest levels of our government. And he's written a book which we carry called Crescent Moon Rising. Crescent Moon Rising is the story of the terrorist training camps in America. Now, you would think if we had terrorist training camps in America, something would be done to stop them. You would think that if we had terrorist training camps in America, they were training terrorists to go over to Afghanistan to kill American soldiers, something would be done to stop them. But then, ladies and gentlemen, we live in a world gone mad, and only by understanding that can you make any sense out of what's going on today. Recently, of course, the United States transferred 20 F-16 fighters to Egypt, along with a large number of tanks and a lot of heavy munitions. Why would we give those to Egypt? We gave them $250 million to help stabilize their government. Why would we do that? Why would we be helping Egypt? Because Egypt certainly has more or less renounced their treaty with Israel, the peace treaty, and certainly that looks like there may well be a conflict between Egypt and Israel. So why would we be funding Israel's enemy when we're supporting Israel? So many things don't make sense. Why are we over there in Syria today? We have troops, and you can check this out on the internet. Don't take my word for it. We have special forces troops in both Jordan and Turkey training the rebels who are fighting there or trying to overthrow the government. Why would we be funding the people who are trying to overthrow the government? Why are we over there? Certainly, Assad was not a good man. He's the president there of Syria, but at least there was a peace between Syria and Israel, and certainly if Assad is overthrown or the terrorists take over, there'll be a threat to Israel, and they're even talking about the necessity of Israel perhaps going into Syria to actually keep the terrorists from getting the chemical weapons. Of course, where did Assad get chemical weapons? Why, he got them from Saddam Hussein. Before we invaded Iraq, this was probably about 2002, And, of course, where did Saddam Hussein get the chemical weapons? Why, we built them for him. We gave it to him. Certainly back in the 1980s when he was at war with Iraq. So there's so many things going on today that just don't make sense. Well, we've got Paul with us right now. Hi, Paul. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, Dr. Stan, no place I'd rather be.
Well, Sunday, we're talking about your book, Crescent Moon Rising, and this is I'm going to let you talk about the book here. Go right ahead.
Well, my book deals with the rise of Islam in the United States, not in Europe, but in the U.S. people know that, for instance, in Great Britain right now, that, that the Islamic population is increasing 10 times that of the other.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Go right ahead, Paul.
But in the United States, Islam is now the second largest religion. It has surpassed Judaism by several million. And by 2050, according to all demographers, including the Pew Research Group, it will become the dominant religion in our country. And that's what really my book is about. How Islam came here. It really came here after 1965. How it was supported largely by our government. And how even like these radical mosques have brought in terrorists, have brought in people who are really unaware of any American values, but they have brought them in here by the tens of thousands, and how America is being transformed from within. But I look upon my book as a sequel to Brotherhood of Darkness.
Well, I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book, and I commend you for it. But basically, the problem we have is that the average American finds it almost impossible to believe that we would be actively encouraging not only the Muslim faith, but this radical jihadist movement, and that there are actually Muslim Islamic terrorist training camps right here in the United States, and nobody ever talks about them.
Well, yes, and we will talk about them right now, but before we even get into that, we should look at the mosques, the most radical mosque in the United States. For instance, Majid Al Farouk in Brooklyn at the 500 block of Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. The Majid Al Farouk has been the first cell of Al Qaeda was planted there. The assassination of Rabbi Kahani was planned there. The architects of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing were located there, including Blind Sheikh Rahman. The members of the Farouk Mosque attempted to blow up every bridge and every major building in New York City until they were caught. The Farouk Mosque had raised by 2001 over $24 million for Al Qaeda. Now, what's surprising is, to me, is that since 1980, the Farouk Mosque has
I'm going to ask you to hold that for just a moment. We'll bring all of our stations right back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess it's Paul Williams, who's written a wonderful book we carry called Crescent Moon Rising, and he's simply talking about what's going on here in the United States. And then in Brooklyn, there is a mosque, it's called the Farouk Mosque, and basically this is a center for terrorist planning here in America. It was here that the assassination of Rabbi Kahana was planned as a couple of decades ago. It was here that the bombing of the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center was planned. It was here certainly that they actually set up a plan to blow up almost all the buildings in New York City. Of course, fortunately, the plan was exposed and it didn't actually take place. But of course, the mosque there in Brooklyn has raised some $24 million or something similar to that for Al-Qaeda and is funding the Al-Qaeda movement that we're fighting over there. And you really wonder, they have these mosques, of course, everything is being done to encourage Muslims to come into this country. They're probably, well, I'll let Paul give you an idea what's happened, but we had almost no mosques and no Muslims in America prior to 1965 when Ted Kennedy passed new immigration legislation and promised the American people that this would in no way change the demographic makeup of America. But, of course, it has. It's changed it dramatically to the point where today the Muslim faith is the second largest faith in the United States. It surpassed the Jewish faith. But go right ahead.
Well, what I want to say about the Farouk Mosque is that I uncovered the fact that since 1980, the Farouk Mosque, and once again, this is just one mosque, just one radical mosque in the United States, has received over $2 million a year from the CIA. Over $2 million a year. Now, imagine the CIA funding a synagogue. I mean, the outrage that would take place. Or if they were funding a fundamentalist Christian group. But just that one mosque, Dr. Stan, it has received, and now this is the most radical mosque, the mosque that wants to blow America off the face of the earth, has received during the 80s. Now, I couldn't kind of understand that, because in the 80s they thought that the Farouk Mosque was a recruiting station for people to go over and engage in the holy war against the Soviets in Afghanistan. Okay, that might make a little bit of sense that the Reagan administration agreed to do that. But why during the 1990s? I mean, why? Why are we in the Farouk Mosque right now? If you go there on any given Sunday, the members of the mosque withdraw fully automatic weapons, semi-automatic weapons. They withdraw shotguns, they withdraw pistols, and they go to the Calverton shooting range in Long Island. And at the end of the day, when they finish target practice, they take all the weapons and they store them back in the mosque.
And you say so, they actually have automatic, fully automatic weapons?
Yes, Kalashnikov and AK-47.
How could they do that? They're illegal in the United States. Why would this radical mosque be allowed to do that? Why would the CIA be funding them? That doesn't make sense.
Well, it even makes less sense when you realize that their activities have been photographed for years by the FBI. I mean, I've seen the footage. The FBI and anybody listening to me right now can verify for themselves has taken footage of members of that mosque withdrawing this type of highly sophisticated weaponry from the Farouk Mosque, and at the end of the day, storing the weapons there. So that the Farouk Mosque, no less than the Red Mosque in Islamabad, serves as an arsenal.
Well, there are so many things going on, ladies and gentlemen, that don't make sense unless you understand that we are doing everything we can to build up this radical Islamic movement, the finest enemy that money could buy. And when you understand that, so many of the things that Paul has uncovered begin to make sense. But you go right ahead, please.
Well, as you said, Dr. Stan, prior to 1965, there were only seven mosques in the United States, and Orthodox mosques, and I'm talking about the Nation of Islam. But these mosques, all the most heavily attended mosque in the United States, had less than 100 adherents. So you had seven mosques that were tiny. When Malcolm X was assassinated in New York in 1965, they could not find a mosque. Now, just think about this. I'm talking 1965. There wasn't one mosque in the five boroughs of New York from which to bury him. And there wasn't one imam in the country who was capable of performing the ceremony. They had to bring in an imam from Saudi Arabia to preside over the ceremony, which took place in a Christian church. Now, that's in 1965. But at that time, we decided to do away with the quota system. But before that time, we believed that we had the best country in the world, that the religious makeup, the ethnic makeup, the cultural makeup was ideal, that we were the light to the world. And we had a quota system, which meant that since 60% of our population were Anglo-Saxon, they're from the U.K., that 60% of the immigrants who came in here would have to come from the UK. Since 20% were the population was German, 20% of the immigrants who came to the United States could come from Germany. And once again, you got the remaining 20% were primarily, once again, Western Europeans, French, Italians, Poles. But what happened was we did away with that quota system. And we decided to open our gates to the third world, to all of the world, to the Islamic world. And since that time, America has undergone an enormous change that nobody wants to talk about. A change that's a religious change, that's a cultural change, that's a linguistic change, that's a change in the very basic fabric of our culture. And all this occurred since 1965. So before that time, we believed in nationalism. We believed in patriotism. We did not believe in geo economics. We did not believe in global a global community. We did not believe that diversity was a virtue. We did not believe that multiculturalism was something that we should strive for. But now, since 1965, we have adopted all these things. So that if you talk to college students right now, by and large, every one of them will say, oh, it's wonderful that our culture is so diverse now. It's wonderful that we are so multicultural. And unfortunately, the American people are unaware of the fact that every time a culture becomes multicultural, and once a civilization like ours becomes diverse, it collapses. If that happened to ancient Israel, it happened to ancient Greece, it happened to Rome, it happened to Italy after the Renaissance, it happened to Great Britain. Every nation in the world that has become multicultural and diverse has collapsed.
And of course, the thing is, because the people don't have a loyalty to the country. The people coming into America from other countries don't understand our Constitution. They think all they have to do is come here and vote, and people will give them things if they get the right politician in. They'll give them a lot of things. America was founded basically on the concept of limiting the power of government so that men could be free, with the adage that those will not be ruled by God, will be ruled by tyrants. And basically, of course, they have systematic destroyed the religious foundation of this country, and we're seeing ever more power being given to the centralized government, and we are increasingly being ruled by tyrants. But the people coming into America, nice people, they want a better life, but they do not understand that America was unique because we had no ruler, we had no king, no emperor, we simply had a limited form of federal government, and matters having to do with life, liberty, and property were to be taken care of at the state and the local level and never handled by the central government, because our founding fathers recognized that if the federal government could manage our problems, the federal government would have to be able to control us. That is why it's such a terrible mistake to bring in people who have no idea what America's about. But go right ahead, Paul.
Dr. Stan, you're hitting, you know, what happens, and this is what people aren't aware, for instance, like of the Muslims who are coming here, we have over 7 million right now, and 115,000 every year arrive with work visas, with family reunification visas, much more than that, than 115,000 arrive with student visas and travel visas. I'm not even counting them. But in addition to that, you have 80,000 arriving here every year as refugees. Now, what happens is these refugees primarily are in refugee camps. They're in refugee camps in Afghanistan. They're in refugee camps in out on the outskirts of Somalia, in the Sudan. They are uprooted, and they're brought here, and they have no idea what America is. They have no idea of our values, of our ideals, of our way of life. But they are taken up, they're uprooted, and they're planted here. And places like Lewiston, Maine, and there are places in Georgia where overnight 15,000 to 20,000 of these people suddenly arrived. And that put an incredible load on the local social agencies and the local education system, and the local economy. And it transformed life. But people in Georgia and people in Lewiston, Maine, and people in Michigan, where this has happened, are aware of what I'm saying. But by and large, Americans at large do not know what's taking place all around them. And that's the problem. They're not aware that right now we have, in 2008, we had 7 million, according to Cornell University and according to the New York Times. But right now, we have infinitely more than that. We have at least 10 million. And we have less than 5 million Jews in this country. So Islam is becoming every day more and more and more a factor in American life, and it's transforming everything about us, not only gradually, but very rapidly.
Hold the thought. Paul, you go right ahead.
The way you can really see it is if you go into our schools, if you go to our public, like the University of Michigan, the University of Connecticut, places like that, you will find during the day the call to prayer over the loudspeakers. You don't hear people over the loudspeakers calling people to say prayers for Christians, like the Angelus at noon for Catholics. You would never expect that. But in the prison system, if you're a young black prisoner and you do not convert to Islam in the prison system, you need to have your head examined, because in the prison system, Muslims have demanded the creation of their own mosque. There are no Christian churches in their prison system. There are no synagogues in our prison system. There are no Hindu temples, but in every federal penitentiary throughout the country right now, there's a mosque. The Muslims who are in prison right now demand special food. They have their own kitchens for halal food. They don't eat the slop that the other prisoners have to eat every day. They're exempt from work detail five times a day for prayer. They're exempt from work detail the entire month of Ramadan. They refuse to be subjected to body searches. So they can, if anything is being smuggled into the prison, it's being smuggled by the Muslims. They grant each other protection in the prison system. They have their own little fraternity. So once again, if you're tossed into that system and you do not become a Muslim, especially if you're an African American, something's the matter with you. Because if you're tossed in with the general population, you're not granted protection. You're not granted exemption from your work detail. You're not exempt from body searches. You have to eat the same slop as everybody else. But once that is what, and you see it in our schools, Dr. Stan. In our schools throughout the country right now, Muslim students are granted special rooms where they can go to pray. That, once again, this is creeping Sharia, and we see it more and more and more. When you go to airports right now, you see footpaths and special places where Muslim cab drivers can stop and pray. You don't see that for Christians. You don't see that for anyone else. But it is happening in our country, and it's once again, it's happening at an accelerated rate. And most Americans don't want to hear about this. They don't want to hear that. What Ted Kennedy opened the door to in 1965 is something that is going to spell the end of America as we know it. But I have tried to get this word out, and I have in the past, for instance, I was always welcome on Fox News. I was always even welcome on MSNBC and ABC and places like that. But what happened is in recent years, with the Saudi investment in, especially News Corporation, when the second largest shareholder right now is a Saudi prince, you can't appear on Fox News anymore. You can't give a message that I'm giving right now and that I used to give at Fox. I'm barred from doing that. You're not welcome anymore on a CBS or NBC where I appeared before, because those doors are closed.
Hold that thought, Paul. We'll be back here in just a moment with all of our stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Paul is simply saying that if you are a black man in prison, why is it that you are almost forced to join the Muslim faith, to convert to the Muslim faith? Why? Well, because in the prison, that's a pretty unruly place, and you need protection. And if you are a Muslim, the Muslims will protect you. If you're in the general prison population without someone to protect you, you can be subject to all sorts of violence. And basically, of course, if you're a Muslim in American prisons today, you get special food, extra good food. They don't have to eat the same food that everybody else eats. They get certainly off from working, important work details, five times a day to pray. They have special places to pray. They get off the whole month of Ramadan because, of course, you can't work during Ramadan. There are all sorts of special privileges you get if you are a prisoner in an American prison today and you're a Muslim. Now, Christians don't get any special consideration. They don't have any special meals for them. They don't have any special places for them to pray or time for them to pray. But if you're a Muslim, you get special privileges in the United States prison population. Why is that? Well, it's because there are some powerful forces that are encouraging the Muslim faith right here in America. Please go right ahead, Paul.
Well, once again, Dr. Standish, you see it all around us. And nobody utters a word of protest. For instance, in Dearborn, if you go to Dearborn during the Arab Festival every year, and you're on a public street, this takes place in public streets, and you go there with a Christian pamphlet or a Christian Bible, you're not allowed in the festival. The police will stop you because they say that you're trying to disseminate hateful information. I'm talking about Bibles. You can't do that. And this is in a public street in Dearborn. But once again, you know, this is all part of a very well-financed plan to bring about the transformation of America. And it's occurring, as I said before, very, very rapidly, not only in the prisons, but in the schools. If you have a student right now in a public school in a major metropolitan area, you will know that all the Islamic schools are excused from their academic studies to recite the Basrama at least twice a day, because that would be during the school hours. They have to do it five times a day, but during the school hours, twice. You will see that in not only in the prisons, but in the schools, in the colleges. For instance, I taught Islam in college for years and years and years. I have a PhD in comparative religions. I mean, I studied. I know the Quran backwards and forwards almost as much as I know the scriptures. I know the hadiths. I've studied these. I know the life of Muhammad. This was my background. Once again, it wasn't a light background. It was 10 years of study. You know, 4 years for undergraduate, 3 years for my master's degree, and 3 years for my PhD. I can't teach Islam in a college because I'm an Occidental. And anybody who's white and a Christian can't teach that subject. You have to be a Muslim. I mean, this is, once again, you know, Muslims can on the other hand, they can teach about Christianity. So we're seeing this. We're seeing this occur more and more. We're seeing in Christian churches, for instance, right now, that they, in many churches, like they call these churches Faith United throughout the country, and there are hundreds of them. They're not only Bibles in the pews, but they're copies of the Quran. And this is, and they're creating something called Chrislam, which is a syncretism of Christianity and Islam. But like I said, you know, most Americans are either blindly unaware, or they think this is a salubrious development. But let me go on about something else. If you go into Brooklyn, for instance, where I spend a great deal of time, or Atlanta, or Detroit, or L.A., and I've been to all these places, I've been at the mosque, I've been at the Islamic centers. But let's just look at Brooklyn. At Brooklyn, in the street corners right now, you can buy something called khat, K-H-A-T, which looks like rhubarb. And you chew it. It's a hallucinogen, but the Muslims from Somalia love it. And it blackens your teeth, it ruins your mind, it destroys your brain cells, but it's illegal, but you can get it on every street corner. In Brooklyn right now, 44,000 women have undergone female genital mutilation, female circumcision. And that's a process that's done in Brooklyn right now with the lids of cans with
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
While a storm cloud gathers far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices in a solemn prayer.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Paul is simply talking about the concept of female circumcision or female mutilation, as they cut off the clitoris, and they do this with a little piece of tin can or something of the sort. This is going on in New York today. And where is the outcry? Well, of course, it's deafening and it's silence. Go right ahead.
And Dr. Stan, as you know, as a surgeon, this process, by and large, is done not on grown women. This is done on infants. And you got 44,000 that in New York right now. Exactly. Where is the outcry? Where's the concern? You can't. Speaking like I'm speaking right now, by the way, according to the United Nations, it's supposed to be a crime, because anyone that says anything that defames or it says anything negative about Islam is supposed to be a criminal offense, according to the UN, and Hillary Clinton supports that. So where are the Christians? Where are the Americans? Where's the concern? I mean, I speak like this, and I'm a welcome, once again, I said it before, I'm no longer welcome on Fox News. I can buy that. I'm no longer welcome on MSNBC. I can buy that, or CBS, and I can buy all that, because these places, Saudis have invested highly in these places. In the last 3 years, for instance, in major news outlets, the Saudis have invested over $100 billion. I can understand that. But where are the churches? The most significant religious development of our time is taking place before our eyes. The entire religious landscape is being radically altered, and not one Christian church expresses the least bit concern about it. Not the mega churches, not the Southern Baptist, certainly not the mainline denominations, not the Catholics. As a matter of fact, since Vatican II, Catholics believe that Islam is a legitimate religion, that it's no less than Judaism. It's a way to salvation, and we have accepted all this.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Paul Williams. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Paul Williams. His book, at least the one we're talking about tonight, is Crescent Moon Rising. Crescent Moon Rising. We carry the book because we think it's vitally important that you read this book and you really understand about the invasion taking place in America, the subversive activity where people are being trained to hate America and undermine the basic fundamentals of this country, the subversive activities of Mr. Gulen, a multi-billionaire, one of the richest men in America, who you'll never hear mentioned. Why? Because he gets his money from the CIA, and he is sort of setting up radical Islamic schools, both in the United States, and literally thousands of these all across the Islamic world, and of course, training the youth to this concept of reinstitution of the Ottoman Empire, and how wonderful it's going to be when all of Islam is joined together as they once were under Ottoman control. But you go right ahead.
Let's talk a second about Gulen. Fethullah Gulen was kicked out of Turkey. There were indictments, warrants for his arrest. This is in 1998, because he was trying to overthrow the secular government. Well, since he was on the run, he came here. And here, from 1998, he created the Justice and Development Party, a political party, which now rules Turkey. And Prime Minister of Turkey, is a member of the Gulen movement. Abdul Gul, the President of Turkey, is a member of the Gulen movement. Every leading Turkish official is a member of the Gulen movement. And that government of Turkey has transformed from a secular state in 1998 to a state with the highest number of active mosques per capita of any place in the world. There are now 90,000 imams in Turkey, more imams than teachers and physicians and scientists combined. If you're a journalist now, you've been subjected to terror raids. You've been thrown in the slammer. If you were a member of the former military, same thing. They were rounded up and thrown in the slammer without any rights. You got places like Hagia Sophia, the birthplace of Eastern Christian Orthodoxy, is now being transformed into a mosque. I mean, this is a major development, but nobody's paying one bit of attention to it. But Gulen has not only toppled the government there, but he has established schools throughout Central Asia, all the newly created Russian republics, Turkmenistan, Kurdistan, all the stand countries throughout Central Asia. He has established thousands of schools there, and the students are all taught there. They're all Turkified. They're all steeped in they do speak the Turkish language, but they're all it's renewed. This idea of the Ottoman Empire has to come back, and all the Muslims have to unite throughout Central Asia to create this new world order. And Gulen believes that his schools can do this, and he's right. They are. I mean, they're all uniting under Turkey.
But why would the CIA be funding so much of this? I mean, that is the question. Why would we be trying to build up a powerful Islamic empire again? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, not only that, Dr. Stan, but looking at Gulen, I looked into his financial, the FBI did, and Homeland Security. They wanted to throw him out of the country. But his personal assets were revealed in the court documentation when he applied for permanent residency. And at that time, he had between $25 to $30 billion, which means that he was wealthier than Bill Gates. And where did he get that money? Well, it came out there as well. He's being funded by the... Look at... Well, I'm not talking... Your listeners have to just stop and pause what I just said, because that's a court record. It's not coming from Paul Williams. It's not coming from Dr. Stan. It's not coming from even Radio Liberty. This is coming from the court records in Philadelphia, from Gulen himself. What he has, $25 to $30 billion in personal assets. Where did he get that kind? Look at that. What you can do with that kind of money? Well, with that kind of money, he has established schools also throughout the United States, not only throughout Central Asia, but about 150 schools throughout the country that are charter schools. And that means that he doesn't even need to pay a dime from his $25 to $30 billion, because these charter schools are funded by us. We pay for it, lock, stock, and barrel. And not only that, but we permit these schools not only to be established and to flourish here, but the teachers there, by and large, are Turks. They're not American teachers. They're imported from Turkey. They have H-1 visas. The administrators are all Turks. The people that build these schools are all Turkish contractors, to a man. And they have these innocuous-sounding names, like the Sonoran Academies in Arizona, the Lisa Academies in Arkansas, the Magnolia Science Academies in California, the Fulton Sunshine Schools in Florida, the Frontier Schools of Missouri, the Horizon Science Academies in Ohio, the Dove Science. Who would believe Dove Science Academy is really a Turkish school to bring about the new Islamic world order? Nothing about the name signifies that. The Harmony Schools in Texas. What they do is they don't teach religion, Islam, there in the school, but all the teachers become mentors for the students. They take the students under their wings. They bring them to Turkish cultural affairs, and they bring them to their homes and to their families, and they're all steeped in Islam by example. And they believe that's the best way to indoctrinate Islam into a student. It's called tebligh, very subtle a way to make a young person taking place once again throughout the United States. And Gulen and his administrators themselves say that the purpose of his movement, the purpose of the schools, is to create a new Islamic world order. And guess what? We're paying for it.
Now, where did that $25 to $30 billion come from? I mean, certainly Bill Gates got his money from Microsoft, and Warren Buffett got his money from extensive financial investment, but where did Gulen get that money? Who gave it to him? How was he able to get it?
Well, it's very easy. If you talk to anybody who served in Afghanistan and came back, any soldier who's there now, they'll tell you, my nephews were there, they'll tell you the same thing. First of all, the number one thing, if you're in country over there, you cannot step in the poppy fields. You cannot destroy the poppy fields.
In other words, they're growing opium over there, and we are guarding those poppy fields, and we are being certain. Basically, because the Taliban had done away with the poppy fields, we went in there, and one of the major things we accomplished was to get those poppy fields blooming again, growing drugs, which are certainly a phenomenal source of income for the CIA, which is working very closely with Mr. Gulen. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely, Dr. Stan. And this is going back even to the Air America in the Vietnam era. We protect but right now from Turkey, we have cargo planes. There's a drug route coming right from Afghanistan. It goes from Afghanistan through Iran to the Anatolian plains of Turkey, and from there, our own cargo planes, our U.S. Military cargo planes. Transports these opiates to the United States. I mean, that's a known fact. And the money from these operations go to fund people like Gulen. And they go to fund people like Gulen. They'll give you this reason. They'll say, well, if you look at Central, like people like Graham Fuller, they'll say, if you look at what he's doing, he's lessening the Soviet influence there. He's making the country more friendly toward the Turks, and since we have some type of an alliance with the Turks, we can get access to the enormous oil and natural gas reserves that are in Central Asia. And if we don't do that, if we don't support people like Gulen, the Soviets will take it over. That's the rationale. So right now, in every Gulen school in Central Asia, you have a CIA agent right within the school.
I think that's a very important statement. In almost every one of the Gulen schools, all throughout, we're talking about literally thousands of them throughout the Middle East. Why, of course, there's a CIA agent there. We are creating, ladies and gentlemen, the best enemy money could buy. Why would you do something like that? Well, if you want to have a war, you got to have an enemy, don't you? And American tax dollars at work. Go right ahead.
And not only that, Dr. Stan, but they're trying to create. They have been trying to create now for years, including the neocons who are, they're trying to create, it's not only a new Islamic world order, it's a new world order. And as you know, and it gets right out of Brotherhood of Darkness, but it's doing away with nationalism, it's doing away with Christianity, any national religion, any religion that comes from the Western tradition. We're trying to do away with all that and blend it into this common soup that will be advantageous for a certain amount of people who have been planning and engineering this and condoning it. But it's an intelligence operation. It's something that's not taking place haphazardly. It's not something that's being taken place even with the best of all possible motives, for instance, to make the world safe for democracy. That has no play at all here. But what we're doing is, by bringing in all these Muslims into the United States, permitting people like Gulen to operate in an unabated manner, permitting these radical mosques to continue to spew anti-American venom, we are really doing more and more. We're eroding our values, and we're eroding our heritage, and we're eroding the fact that we were once bonded by blood. We're eroding all that, so that we're going to be open to something that's supranational, that's supra, so to speak, Christian, that involves all mankind in this one effort called globalism.
That's absolutely right, and that's what's so hard for people to understand. There is a reason for everything going on, but you're never going to get this through regular channels. Well, Paul, I know you don't have a website, but where would you suggest that people go to get more information on what you're talking about? And certainly we do carry your book, Crescent Moon Rising. We think it's an important book, but is there anything, any place you'd like to recommend people to go to get more information on what you're talking about?
Yeah. There are several things that your listeners can do, and I speak from my heart. I have been sued by the Muslims, my wife and I, for programs like this. I mean, sued to the extent of that we were wiped out financially, because you speak like this and you're going to pay a price. So there's some people that really are brave and deserve to be supported. One is this station right now, Dr. Stan and Radio Liberty, because this is where you're going to get the truth. There are other outlets too, for instance, like Southwest Radio Ministries. You can generally get a good word from them, but the places are few and far between. What your listeners have to do is go to your listen, continue to listen to Radio Liberty, listen to your programs, take what I'm saying, and don't even believe me. Do the research yourself. Go look at Gulen. Look what's been exposed about him. Look at places like Jamaat al-Fukra that have established paramilitary compounds throughout the United States, and just dig a little bit further and find out how these places, these compounds, are funded. And you will find out that Sheikh Jilani, who established all these compounds throughout the United States, just like Gulen, was a CIA operative. Why would we allow this? Why are these camps right now that Jilani has established, like Islamberg, the Red House, places that I've gone and visited, where raw recruits, people by and large African Americans from the prison system, are trained in that they receive their basic training and these compounds, and they're sent from there to Pakistan, and from Pakistan, they're no longer going into Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. They're going into Afghanistan to fight us. And Jilani, just like Gulen, is still receiving subsidies from the CIA. Why? Why are these places allowed to continue? At Islamberg, for instance, I was up there many times, and what you'll find is you'll find obstacle courses. You'll find firing ranges. You'll find landing strips. You will find underground bunkers. You will find recruits being trained with Kalashnikov and AK-47. Right in rural areas of New York, the neighbors have all complained to high heaven. They've called the law enforcement agency. They're driven to a distraction, and nothing is done. Throughout southern Virginia, the same thing. The neighbors have around Red House. They're constantly exposed to the explosions over weekends coming from the compounds, from the sound of fully automatic and semi-automatic weaponry being unloaded, and they've complained, and nothing is done. Now, we know about these compounds. We know that Richard Reed was associated with Jilani and Jamaat al-Fukra. We know that the Beltway snipers were protected there. And yet, I mean, what happened is some local law enforcement agents have raided some of these compounds, probably by mistake. But like in Buena Vista, Colorado, they raided the compound. They found counterfeit passports, counterfeit driver's licenses. They found fully automatic weaponry. They found plastique explosives. Same thing up in Balladula, California, where it was raided. But once again, these places, they're raided, they're shut down, and they open up again a couple miles down the road.
And for our listeners who don't know, Richard Reed was the shoe bomber. You remember the shoe bomber was supposed to blow up the airplane by lighting the fuse to the C4 explosives in his shoes, because it didn't tell poor Richard that you can't set off a C4 explosives with a fuse. You have to have a blasting cap. So he'll spend the rest of his life in prison because the people who built his shoes, the bombs in his shoes, did it so that the bombs wouldn't go off. They didn't want to blow up an airplane, but they didn't want to create the impression in the minds of the American people that we have this terrible threat of terrorism in America. And not only that, but of course Richard Reed wasn't he part of that mosque, the Farouk Mosque in Brooklyn?
Yes, he was.
Okay,
and it's all combined. And Jelani, who's the founder of a lot of these compounds, spoke at that mosque on numerous occasions.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is what we're really up against. Now, you're not going to get this information from ABC, CBS, or NBC. You're not going to hear about these Islamic training camps, and certainly Paul says that somewhere between 48 and 60 of them across America, where they're actively training people with automatic weapons and military, and then of course they send them over to Pakistan, and they go down into Afghanistan, they kill the American soldiers, but nobody wants to tell you that sort of thing. Paul, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Oh, 3 minutes, that's great. You know, I spoke about some conservatives, oddly enough, should delight in the arrival of Islam and the Islamic transformation of America, because what it will mean is there will be a stricter code of law and enforcement under Sharia law. There will be an end to the feminist movement under Sharia law. There will be an end to same-sex marriage and gay rights under Sharia law. These things will come about. Of course, under Sharia law, we'll also lose all of our freedom. And if you're a Christian, you'll be demoted to a dhimmi, which means that even if you try to erect a church, you have to do it with the Islamic permission. If you're a dhimmi, you have to walk around with an identifying badge that means that you are not a Muslim, and you cannot be treated as a full human being, but only a half human being. And it means that you only have very, very specific rights. And among those rights is not the right to proselytize or to speak about your religion or to speak about anything that might be slightly defamatory against the prophet. So, if in fact you are of that ilk, where you think that the loss of freedom is no big deal, then maybe you're looking upon this development as something good. A lot of the people who were behind, including the CIA, when I look at people like Fuller and these other places, people who are involved in the change of...
Hold that thought for just a moment. And so Dave Paul is simply saying that the people from the CIA are really behind this whole radical Islamic movement here in the United States. Once again, why would they do that? Well, if you don't have an enemy, how can you certainly mobilize the people against the enemy? Paul, we're going to have to let you go. We're out of time, but we'll have to do it again sometime real soon.
That's what I want to say is many of them in the CIA are Masons.
Right, and I'm sure they are, and behind
they
everything
are.
Going on are the powerful spiritual forces that you and I both recognize are energizing this whole demonic movement. God bless, and thanks very much, Paul.
God bless you, too.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Paul Williams, and of course, basically, his book is called Crescent Moon Rising. Crescent Moon Rising, and so that you would probably want to get a couple of my interviews with Paul. We've done a number of them. We may even put them together into a 4-CD set if there's any demand for it. But he's a fascinating source of information. And I've learned so much from certainly reading his material, and then of course you can check it out on the internet. I will tell you he's writing another book, fascinating, and I can hardly wait for that one to come out on an entirely different subject, but I can hardly wait to get the information to my listeners that Paul has uncovered in this latest book that he's doing. But right now, certainly if you'd like to get the book Crescent Moon Rising, you'd like to get my book, Going Into the Background of the Brotherhood of Darkness, that's the title of the book. Why, they're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. We have a four-tape set on the Muslim faith. You need to understand, ladies and gentlemen, that we're involved in a spiritual battle, and there are powerful spiritual forces out there that want to destroy Christianity. We have a four-CD set on the supernatural. We have a four-tape set, on the spiritual warfare, and they're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. Then, of course, we hope you want to get my talk on Agenda 21, the covert plan, and there's a syllabus that goes with that. We actually have all sorts of information put out by the other side that tells you they want to destroy America. They want to destroy Western civilization. There is a plan, and you can actually read what they say in their own words. That's the Agenda 21 syllabus. You get my talk on population control, the covert agenda. And ladies and gentlemen, they've already killed several billion people through abortion, through euthanasia. And of course, they prevented the birth, certainly, of billions of people by sterilization and contraceptives. But they do intend to kill off most of the population of the world. And people say, why would anybody in their right mind want to do that? The answer is, we're not dealing with people with their right mind. Do you know there are all sorts of treatments for cancer that you can get in other countries that you can't get here in America? Do you know that a lot of people with cancer have had the alternative treatments and gotten better? We have a great four-tape set on why do we still have cancer? We have a four-tape set on Laetril. And, of course, we have certainly so much information. You need to get our catalog and look at it, and look at all the tape sets and the DVDs and the CD sets and videos we offer. To understand what's happening, you certainly have to learn how to protect your health. You have to understand that they're spraying. They're putting aluminum into our atmosphere. It's coming down, getting into the soil, getting into the trees, getting into our food, getting into the animals that we eat. And basically, that's the DVD entitled Geoengineering. We also have a 4-CD set on geoengineering, so we have both the DVD and the 4-CD set. We have the same thing with aspartame. We have an excellent DVD on aspartame. We have a 4-CD set on aspartame. You need to understand that they are simply poisoning you. And certainly they're putting mercury into your fillings because they know it's toxic. They're putting mercury into the vaccines and the doctors are giving to you because they don't understand that they're poisoning their patients. There is no safe dose of mercury. They may say that there is, but you're getting phenomenal amounts of it by so many means. Now they're doing away certainly with regular light bulbs, and all the new incandescent light bulbs contain mercury. Never let one of them break. Understand, we're involved in a spiritual battle. They do intend to kill off most of the world's population. Our number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. We'll be back in just a moment.
Let us swear allegiance to a land. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices in a solemn prayer, God bless America. Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you of the views expressed here and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour or so, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, who's the former senior editor of the New American Magazine, who for a time was the Sydney editor of senior writer for the Republic magazine. He's a prolific writer. He's written a number of books. But, of course, he, at present time, Sydney writes the newsletter for Radio Liberty, our monthly newsletter. He writes regularly for lourockwell.com. And Sydney, William is a constant source of information. We try to have him on as frequently as we can. We ought to try to have him on this time every Friday, and simply to wrap up the week. Give us a commentary on what is really going on in the world today, because, ladies and gentlemen, nothing is as it appears to be. Basically, everything is being manipulated. There's a small group of people who really run the world, and they create our perception on so many issues. And the average American just looks and sees these things are unfolding, and they just can't figure out what's going on, and so they don't try. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you that what we have is a situation where a small group of people control both sides. They control the Republican parties, they control the Democrat Party, they control the right, and they control the left, they control the liberals and the conservatives. They have their people infiltrated into every aspect of our society, and it's so vitally important, because that you understand that they have a system of informants all across America, and you can actually go up on the internet and you'll find out the FBI will admit they have over 40,000 informants, certainly, who are spying on you. It could very well be your best friend. I know repeatedly we've had people who tried to infiltrate my little ministry. We know that most of the major ministries, even those where I have very close friends, are you in the ministries, and yet they're ministries have been infiltrated, and I can't tell them that my suspicions. And the reason is, of course, because many times why the infiltrator is their best and closest family friend. Unfortunately, this is the way the world works today. It's a tragic situation, but of course the one thing that the people, members of the Brotherhood of Darkness, fear is that there will be an organized opposition to them. Right now, of course, there's almost no opposition. Congress ordinarily goes along with the various programs, and certainly, but we do have certainly many of our state legislatures, and there are people in some state legislatures who either certainly are basically patriotic, or some of them may actually understand what's going on, but some of our states are actually taking action to negate what the federal government is trying to do. Basically, a majority of the states are not going to go along with Obamacare. A majority of the states are not going to go along with much of the efforts to take disarm the people. And what you need to do is work with your state legislators, try to get people locally to understand what's going on, and then people in your state legislature who will demand that we have states' rights and that the people of this country be allowed to be free. Well, we've got William Grigg with us. Hi, William. How are we doing tonight?
Dr. Stan, I'm doing well. As always, it's really a pleasure and a privilege to be with you.
Well, what are we going to be talking about this evening?
I wanted to springboard from the comment you made just before bringing me on about the fact that we're seeing a number of states here that are making conscious efforts to step away from this collectivist juggernaut, get out of its path, to spare the liberties and the property rights of the people who reside therein, whether you're talking about the Obamacare monstrosity or the impending gun grab. The thing is, we're not living in a decentralized constitutional republic anymore. And
hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back with William Grigg. William, pick up the story there.
Yes, when we're talking about the traditional reserve powers of the state, and, of course, the enumerated rights of the people. The purpose of reserved powers is to protect the rights of the people who are, at least in principle, in charge of state government. We're talking a language that really isn't spoken or recognized or understood or regarded as legitimate by the people who impudently rule us. The assumption here is that the powers that are possessed by the central government are all-encompassing, and that those things that are not explicitly forbidden to them are permitted, and many of those things that are explicitly forbidden to them are only conditionally forbidden until the people running the central government can contrive a suitable pretext for doing those things they're prohibited from doing. And I have to talk once again about this jaw-droppingly brazen and vulgar discussion of executive dictatorship that took place a couple of weeks ago with respect to summary execution. And again, as you pointed out, and it bears repeating, there's nothing new about executive assassination in this country. It's been a policy of the presidency for many decades, if not longer. The biggest difference, of course, is now it's being discussed openly. And you actually have Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, and supposedly the chief constitutional official in the executive branch, saying in so many words that the President of the United States cannot be forbidden by the Congress to execute an American citizen that the President has decided is an enemy of the state, somebody who is a so-called unlawful combatant or a terrorist or a militant. He literally said that the Congress cannot impede the executive in carrying out a function that is not in any way compatible with the constitutional description of the powers of that office. It would be, of course, perversity on stilts from the perspective of the framers of the Constitution to say that the President of the United States, in the constitutional scheme they devised, had greater powers of discretionary killing than the British monarch against whom they had rebelled. George III did not claim the power of summary execution. There had been several centuries earlier, under, I believe, the reign of Charles I, a revolution in Great Britain over the question of the monarchy and whether the monarch of Great Britain had the power to set aside the law and rule by decree. And this was something that was resolved essentially by indicting the king for treason and executing him.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest, William Gregg, is talking about the fact that we have a situation in the United States where the president can have people killed. Now, this has been going on for a long time. It's only recently it's come out. Those of you who haven't heard my 4-CD set on Sydney Deadly Assassins, I actually interview a couple of government assassins. They're not going to tell you about the people that they did kill. They will tell you about the people they didn't kill. One of the assassins is no longer living. The other has disappeared. We don't know what's happened to him. And then, of course, we also interview the man who tracked down the man who was paid by our government, assigned by the CIA, to kill General Patton and contributed and was involved with the death of General Patton. And we even have a book on that, Sydney. Oh, Who Killed Patton, I think is the title of it, or something of the sort, Target Patton, under any circumstances. Well, certainly William is saying that certainly at no time in America has anybody other than said that it was all right for the president to order people killed. And yet, of course, recently, Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, testifying before the Senate, said that certainly, for all intents and purposes, the president did have the right to decree that somebody would be killed. Now, of course, William is taking us back in history. Even certainly George III, at the time of the American Revolution, back in 1776 and 1777, even George III, the British monarch, didn't say that he had the right to kill people. In fact, certainly, it was several centuries earlier when Charles, one of the English kings, had been tried and indicted and ultimately executed because he was killing his subjects. Not even the kings of England today would say they have the right to order people killed, and yet, of course, it's President Obama has said, for all intents and purposes, he has that right. Eric Holder has upheld that. Now, this is not to say that previous presidents haven't gone right along with that, but this is the first time it's come out publicly. And the United States Attorney General has said the president has the right to have people killed, and Congress does not have the right to intervene. Go right ahead.
Yes, I've been referring to Charles I, who is the son of James I, and James I had written a document that was intended to tutor his son in the ways of what we would now call absolutist monarchism, or the rule of a completely unaccountable tyrant. And I believe the name of the document was pronounced Basilicon Doron, and it was meant to be sort of the kind of tutorial in tyranny that Machiavelli's The Prince represented. The biggest difference, of course, is that Machiavelli wasn't necessarily giving this by way of positive advice to rulers. He was simply laying bare the actual governing doctrine and practice of every ruler, paring away all the layers of accumulated persiflage and pretense that enshroud the actual exercise of power. In this case, King James I, as he was preparing to turn over the kingdom to his heir, was explaining to his son how he should behave himself as an absolute monarch. There's a wonderful book that was published a few years ago, it's probably difficult to find now, by a British barrister, a legal expert and lawyer, by the name of Geoffrey Robertson. It's called The Tyrannicide Brief. And in that book, he had this to say about this absolute monarch. James, as the father of Charles I, preached the benefits of what would now be described as a benign political and spiritual dictatorship in which the king governed through an elite, chosen and discarded at his own discretion, comprising his ministers, his bishops, and judges, who must never question the royal prerogative, for that is to take away the mystical reverence that belongs to those that sit in the throne of God. And of course, for pious people in the 16th and 17th century British culture, the idea that a king would consider himself to be divine, not that he ruled pursuant to divine law, but that he himself was divine, was properly considered blasphemy. Ordinary, it's a very commonplace conceit today for people to look upon the President of the United States as if he somehow a superhuman figure who partakes of some element of divinity, and we have this whole cult of personality woven around whoever happens to ascend to the presidency that really would bring a blush to the cheeks of ancient Roman tyrants, up to and perhaps even including Caligula. But in the era of absolute monarchism in Great Britain, you didn't have tyrants of the sort that are now routinely on display in the American presidency. In the Stuart utopia, Robertson points out, once again in this book, The Tyrannicide Brief, Parliament was irritating and irrelevant. The king was to be regarded as absolute master of the lives and possessions of his subjects. His acts were not open to inquiry or dispute, and no misdeeds can ever justify resistance. Now, that's what prevailed under Charles I that provoked a revolution in Great Britain. By that time, this is the 17th century, by that time there was enough understanding of the principle that kings must be ruled by law and that Parliament must have primacy in order to prevent executive despotism, that King Charles I was deposed, put on trial for treason, and then executed as a traitor to the Commonwealth. Now, that was the doctrine of absolutism that predated by over roughly a century, of the American Revolution. King George III was by no means that type of a tyrant, and so he was considered by the colonists, by the patriots who founded the American Republic, as somebody who was a tyrant under whose rule they would no longer see fit to endure. And so they resisted and rebelled and seceded from the British Empire on the basis of largely notional tyrannical acts by King George and Parliament. They were not, at the time of the American Revolution, being as oppressive as they had a few years earlier, because Parliament was smart enough to know that they had to gear down occasionally so as not to incite revolt on the part of their subjects. But they claimed the impose all these horrible taxes and other impositions at a time of their choosing. And so the American Revolutionary War, the war for American secession, if you will, secession from the empire, was actually waged on the basis of things that Parliament might do rather than that which it was doing at the time. That being the case, though, the framers of the United States Constitution made it clear that they wanted the legislative branch to have primacy and the executive to have very modest and carefully enumerated powers. They would consider it to be a screaming obscenity that a president of the United States would claim the authority to order the summary execution of American citizens or their imprisonment under military jurisdiction without any kind of judicial recourse. But that's where we stand right now. And there has been some, if you will, sectarian and partisan debate over the subject. There are many people who, for whatever reason, during the Obama administration, many conservative people, conservative-leaning commentators and politicians, who just in the last year and a half or so are making the original discovery that the presidency is badly overgrown and that powers have been assigned to the presidency or have been usurped by the presidency that make that office really the cockpit of tyranny rather than the modest executive of a constitutional republic. Many of those people weren't around for this discussion 10 years ago or 8 or 9 years ago when you had the Bush administration making extravagant claims of the powers of what they called the unitary executive, when John Yoo and other people beavering away in the Justice Department were emitting memos saying that the president had the right to order torture and those who carried out torture that resulted in homicide were to be considered exempt from punishment on the basis of the fact that they had been carrying out the president's errand. But that's the sort of thing the Obama administration has inherited, and it's only getting worse, and it will continue to get worse, irrespective of the occupant in the White House, his particular partisan flavor or his background or his inclination, because we are no longer governed by law. We're governed, of course, by partisan necessity.
And one of the things that really bothers me, William, is that there's been no outcry from our religious leaders about torture or about torturing people to death. And there were a number of people who were tortured to death back in the early part of the 2003, in that era, and they tortured them to death. Well, they said we really didn't mean to kill them. They just happened to die when we were torturing them.
Yeah.
And they even said they tried one of these men, and of course he was exonerated, and there were cheers from the people in the audience, for releasing this man who tortured another human being, an Iraqi general, to death. Now, ladies and gentlemen, where are our religious leaders? Where is Franklin Graham, who's recently come out and said, oh, my goodness, you know, I think that we ought to do background checks on people getting, purchasing weapons. Why would Franklin Graham even comment on that? And you would think that he might have at least thought to speak out against torturing people to death, but neither Franklin Graham or any of our other religious leaders, certainly the people who had the Southern Baptist Convention, nobody seems to want to speak on these issues. And we have to ask ourselves why. Go right ahead, William.
And as I pointed out before, there was a survey conducted about 5 years ago of international attitudes about torture. And you had a canvas taken of sentiments among Americans of various religious backgrounds, from Roman Catholic and Evangelical Christian to Jewish and Muslim and various forms of Eastern religions. Agnostics and atheists, of course, were polled as well. And opinion polls were conducted in Asia and Africa and the Middle East. And it turned out that the largest cohort of people who most enthusiastically supported torture were conservative, politically conservative, and theologically conservative American Evangelical Christians. There were far lower returns on behalf of approving torture in the Muslim world than there were among American evangelicals. And there resides a potent indictment of America as a Christian nation, because there is no way that somebody who is an earnest follower of Jesus of Nazareth could countenance the torture of another human being.
I agree with you totally, and this is one of the things that has deeply disturbed me. Of course, not only torture, but torturing people to death, ladies and gentlemen. Where is the outcry? We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg, right here at Radio Liberty. William, you go right ahead.
When we're talking about the consolidation of power in the central government and the destruction of all constitutional restraints on the exercise of that power, we have to talk about the ultimate check rein on political ambition as identified by James Madison, who was by no means an insurrectionist, and that is the individual right to armed self-defense and the right of armed individuals to cohere in an organized fashion to defend themselves against criminal violence, whether waged by private criminals or waged in the name of the central government. James Madison in the Federalist Papers, I believe essay number 46, very candidly set out what some people now disparage as the insurrectionary theory of the Second Amendment, to wit, that the people of the several states, in the capacity of unorganized militia, would be a palpable counterweight to the ambitions of any central government under the control of any ambitious faction that the mind of James Madison could contrive and imagine. I think that that's a really interesting and disturbing thought that he never imagined. And he had a very well-supplied and fecund mind. He never imagined, as far as I could tell, that we would be living under a completely lawless executive-dominated central government. He honestly didn't seem to think that we'd reach a state of affairs where the government of the United States, that is to say the central government, that agent of the state that created it, would be preparing for war against the people in general. Granted, there were some discussions within the lifetime of James Madison during his presidency, as a matter of fact, at the Hartford Convention toward the end of the War of 1812, there were some discussions of people withdrawing from the Union. So secession was something that was well understood as a potential problem or a potential opportunity during the early 19th century. And indeed, James Madison, along with Thomas Jefferson in 1798, wrote a series of essays defending the principle of interposition and the principle of nullification, which are, if you will, sort of the last exit before secession. So these were situations that Madison and Jefferson had imagined, that there would be potentially circumstances in which the states would withdraw from the Union or make preparations to defend themselves against aggression by the central government. I don't know if he would have imagined what happened between 1861 and 1865, but I don't think that even somebody with an imagination as well provisioned as that of James Madison could have conceived of a situation where a completely illegitimate federal agency called the Department of Homeland Security would be laying in store billions of rounds of ammunition with no military use, no conceivable military use, and that could not be suitable for training because of their expense and the fact that this is not something which has generally been used. The hollow point ammunition, of course, is what I'm referring to. Billions of rounds, much of it the hollow point variety, enough to carry out an Iraq-style war for 24 or 30 years while up-armoring every agency of the federal government for the possible contingency of using them to suppress social turmoil or domestic insurrection. And so we've got a situation now where, in spite of the fact that there seems to be at least a tactical retreat going on in the Congress regarding the proposed assault weapons ban, there's still an obvious and escalating campaign against gun ownership here. And actually, the focus of this now...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William is talking about the fact that our federal government is becoming increasingly menacing towards our people. Why would the federal government want 1.6 billion rounds of hollow point ammunition? Why would the federal government be buying thousands, 7,700 assault rifles? At least they call them semi-automatic, but they call them assault rifles, so I'll call them assault rifles. But they're also ordering submachine guns. Why would the federal government be ordering 2,700 armored personnel carriers, the kind that certainly you would use to assault military facilities? Why would our federal government be getting all of this? And this is for the Department of Homeland Security. Are they expecting insurrection? Are they planning certainly on taking away the freedom of the people, and they feel there's going to be a response? Well, certainly, what are your thoughts on that? And pick up the story, William.
I don't know if they're making preparations for the event that we're going to be hit with the type of social turmoil that's descended upon many formerly independent nations that are now constituent elements of this amoebic monstrosity called the Eurozone. That's one possibility. Another possibility here is that we're dealing with preparations for a terrorist attack, whether something that would spontaneously arise from those elements of society that the federal government has so generously seeded with resentment and manipulated, or a legitimate false flag incident where you would have the federal government actually create a precipitating event as a pretext for a crackdown. But the motives for acquiring that amount of ammunition and distributing military hardware to every law enforcement agency, federal, state, or local, in the length and breadth of the 48 contiguous states and elsewhere, the motive for doing this, I think, is self-evident. These are things that bespeak hostile intention. I mean, when you take a look at a story like this out of a little town called Percy, Illinois, this town is really a village, not so much a city or even what most people refer to as a town. It's a village. Its police force consists of 6 part-time officers and 4 reserve officers, and yet they have 10 fully automatic weapons that were provided to them, fully automatic combat assault weapons provided to them by the Department of Homeland Security. You've got a town with 6 part-time police officers. You know, why are they receiving weapons of that sort? Why do you have tiny towns in places like Maine and some places in the Northwest who receive armored personnel carriers and sophisticated surveillance gear and combat-grade weaponry and all kinds of toys and trinkets from the Pentagon, where you have local communities in which violent crime is all but unheard of? Many of these jurisdictions that receive Homeland Security grants and weapons and training from the Pentagon are jurisdictions where the last murder occurred decades ago and where the most important and urgent threat to public order consists of disorderly conduct or drunkenness.
Well, basically what they're doing is militarizing our local police force.
Yeah.
Why would they militarize the local police? That's what they did in Hitler's Germany. You know, this is certainly what they wanted, was a military force, police force, to keep the people in line. Is that what they're planning for America? Where is the justification for this? Go right ahead.
Well, the justification for doing this is that there are people who object to it. This is something that we've seen over the last couple of weeks with the SPLC, the so-called Southern Poverty Law Center, and other groups that are either aligned with the federal government, or in the case of the SPLC, live in symbiosis with the federal government, saying that by virtue of the fact that there are so many people who are riled up over what the federal government is doing, you have justification for the federal government escalating its military and militant stance toward the public. In other words, that they're saying with people like the SPLC and many elements of the controlled media, the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, and others who act as an echo chamber for the regime and its quasi-private police agencies like the SPLC, what they're saying is that the conspiracy theorists are plotting against the government. And because of this low-grade fever of sedition in the country, the federal government must escalate its surveillance of these groups, thereby, of course, creating a very fertile climate in which you can have incidents of the sort that tend to envenom these sides against the other. You set in motion a cycle of escalation and opposition until you have a precipitating event, most likely being planned right now, that would provide this pretext for a crackdown. The SPLC, a couple of weeks ago, said the atmosphere right now is uncannily similar to that before the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. They should know. The SPLC had prior knowledge of many elements of that conspiracy. The federal government precipitated that conspiracy. So when they say things like that, in my opinion, to my cynical ears and eyes, that appears like a warning that we're going to see a false flag event pretty soon.
Well, this evening, William Grigg. We're going to be back here in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen. But remember, there's a small group of people that control our government. And they control the right and the left, the conservative, the liberal, and what we need to do to expose them, we call them the Brotherhood of Darkness.
While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear. from Legion to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices in a solemn prayer.
William, you go right ahead. And incidentally, we got your letter. It's a great letter, and we're working on this right now. Go right ahead.
I really appreciate it. Yeah, it deals with what's happening with the escalating financial collapse coupled with the institutional plunder of the sort that we've seen in Cyprus recently. And I wrote that letter before there were some interesting developments in Cyprus where the legislature apparently has rejected the extortion demands from the EU. And the other interesting thing here is the president of Cyprus had gotten advance notification that the EU was going to require a levy, that is to say, theft from private bank deposits in order to pay back the loans that are being made to that government. This, of course, is pretty much the terminal phase of the economic hitman strategy that's been referred to by Mr. Perkins. You've had him on as a guest. At some point, of course, you end up with a situation where the banks are robbing people in broad daylight. It's more subtle here in the United States, where the Federal Reserve simply steals the value of what we have in our bank accounts. In Nicosia and some other places over in the southern part of the Eurozone, there are going to be, starting with Cyprus and expanding to Italy and Spain and Portugal and elsewhere, there are going to be open and vulgar and outright thefts, outright pilferage from people's bank deposits. And so the Cypriot president had warned his powerful cronies as to what was going to happen. He warned them to get their money out of that country before the levy was imposed. And I think that you have similar arrangements being made right now by the same people who control the media organs that disparage people like you and me, Dr. Stan, in our audience as paranoids and preppers, because we understand the tropism of what's going on now in the direction of a systemic collapse economically and most likely social turmoil and overt police state violence. The same people who disparage us for having that point of view are getting their money out of the country. They're buying up land in Latin America. They're getting their backs up against mountains. They have their places of resort. They, in one instance that I read about in Vanity Fair, are taking out top-scale real estate overseas and then living in a sort of garrison state environment with private security and surveillance cameras meant to protect them rather than to make their actions transparent to the government.
Hold that thought. Hold the thought there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg. And William, go right ahead.
Well, I'd like to pivot from the subject here of plunder to the subject of civilian disarmament, because I think that these are entirely compatible topics. They're facets of the same story. And we described earlier the fact that there has been, I think, a tactical retreat on the firearms front with respect to the federal drive for a national assault weapons ban. Of course, assault weapons refer to weapons that politicians don't like, largely for cosmetic reasons.
But I think that we have to differentiate automatic weapons from semi-automatic weapons.
Yeah.
And basically, automatic weapons are illegal.
Machine guns,
Are illegal. Semi-automatic are not assault weapons, and nobody would go into battle using a semi-automatic weapon. But they call them assault weapons. Why? Because they want, of course, to degrade them. They want to disarm the people. And I simply point out that simply, why are we giving all these assault rifles to our military, to our police? Why should our police have assault rifles? And I think we need to keep pounding away at that, and then, of course, concede they're really not assault rifles. They just use that word to discredit guns, because they hate guns, because guns allow people to defend themselves against the excesses of government. And the reason that we had the Second Amendment was so that people would be able to defend themselves against the excesses of the bureaucrats, because our founding fathers realized you could never trust people with power. The power would be misused. They wanted to take the chains off the people, to put the chains on government, and they wanted the people to be armed, not so they could hunt, not so that they could certainly do target practice. They want them to have weapons to defend themselves against the excesses of government. Go right ahead.
The thing that I want to emphasize here on the subject of civilian disarmament, we have to call it that. They're talking about civilian disarmament. But I want to emphasize the fact that whatever happens in the Senate this year, there are going to be efforts in states that are controlled by collectivist factions. Most of them are. Almost all of them are controlled by collectivism of one variety or another. But in Colorado, of course, we just had a rather radical measure passed that will criminalize possession of so-called large-capacity ammunition clips. If you have those clips, they were perfectly legal until just a couple of days ago. And within a few months, if you still have them, you'll be considered a criminal in spite of the fact that you've done nothing to injure another human being. And you have the same thing going on in New York. And in New York right now, you actually have some very dramatic and very disturbing things happening in terms of creating a Soviet-style system of informants, paid informants, and an invitation by the government for people to rat out their neighbors for the possession of weapons that, until very recently, could be owned by civilians without any legal consequences. The first victim of the new drive, the renewed drive for civilian disarmament in New York, is a fellow by the name, I believe I'm going to pronounce it incorrectly, but I'll try anyway, of Benjamin M. Wassell of Silver Creek. He's a wounded Iraq veteran. He underwent traumatic brain injury as a result of being in the proximity of an IED, if I remember the story correctly. So he's a disabled Iraq War veteran. He's not had any criminal record until recently. He's not a criminal now. It's a very important thing to point out. He may be considered an offender, but that doesn't make him a criminal. He was arrested during an undercover operation by state police in which he was invited to sell them an AR-15 rifle and six large-capacity clips on January 24th. Now, just a few days earlier, the state legislature in New York had enacted, in a panicked and opportunistic rush, the so-called SAFE Act, which is a draconian anti-gun law. In their indecent haste to enact that law, they forgot to exempt military and police officials from its provisions. So they had managed, in one fell swoop, to criminalize law-abiding citizens and to criminalize possession of those same weapons by the people who are supposed to be the deputized agents of law-abiding citizens, because they were pursuing the sympathetic fallacy that certain implements, certain morally neutral tools, are evil. And so they were demonizing the firearm rather than focusing on evil acts committed with that implement. By selling these firearms, this is something that was said after this arrest by Eric Schneiderman, who is the attorney general in the state of New York, as I referred to him, the procurator for the New York State Politburo. He really is, as so many of these people are, a Soviet-style personality. By selling these illegal firearms, stop right there, they weren't illegal until a few days before this transaction. And if you understand how these bureaucracies function, it seems to me that they had set him up before the bill was signed into law. Because it takes a little while to talent scout a patsy and to set in motion a sting operation of the sort that they pulled off. Literally, they invited this guy to a diner and discussed having him sell them some weapons. I mean, this wasn't the sort of thing that happened furtively. This happened in public. It happened at a diner. It didn't happen in some abandoned warehouse somewhere. Anyhow, this is what Eric Schneiderman said about this case. By selling these illegal firearms, Mr. Wassell's actions had potentially dangerous consequences for New Yorkers. We have seen far too much gun violence in our state in recent months, and the sale of illegal semi-automatic weapons will not go unpunished. The sale of illegal semi-automatic weapons. In other words, you're dealing with somebody who was selling guns that he owned, that were not stolen from anybody, for an agreed-upon price, and this transaction was only illegal because of what had happened a few days earlier. Joseph D'Amico, who's the head of the New York State Police, said, quote, "Our partnership with the Attorney General's office has resulted in taking a dangerous criminal off the street." He's not a dangerous criminal. He had no previous criminal record. As far as I'm concerned, he's not a criminal now, simply because he violated a positivist enactment that criminalized what had been a perfectly legal and innocuous transaction. Wasso did violate the new gun law, but he didn't injure anybody and he didn't commit fraud. The fraud that was involved in this transaction was perpetrated by the officials who were working for Schneiderman and Yamico because they arranged the sale on false pretenses. Now, this is something that's very important to recognize here. When you have a law enforcement system that is geared toward making people into criminals as opposed to protecting their rights, fraud is innate to what they do. They're constantly seeking to entice people into doing things that can result in chargeable offenses. If we had a system of law enforcement, I don't like to use the expression law enforcement, I prefer to talk about peace officers, people who protect persons and property are peace officers. And there are some people, perhaps many, who are police officers today who retain a commitment to the ideal of being peace officers. I've written about people like that. I pray for examples of that kind. Every time I come across an example of somebody who's a conscientious police officer who is conducting himself or herself as a peace officer and protecting life, liberty, and property against not merely criminal violence by private sector actors, but abuses carried out under the color of law. Every time I come across an example of that sort, I put it up in light and shine a spotlight on it because I'm desperate to find stories like that. But the difference between law enforcement and the role of a peace officer has to do with the fact that a peace officer protects life, liberty, and property. A law enforcement officer acts to the state, if you will, in the capacity of the edge to the blade. In other words, he's something, he's turned himself into part of an apparatus that has no respect for life, liberty, and property. Now, if you're dealing here with a system of law, a law enforcement system that is geared to create crime, to entice people into committing criminal offenses so as to fill the jails and to fill our probation and parole system, then you're dealing with a system that is rooted in institutional fraud and abuse. If we had a system where police acted the same way that a fire department behaves, I mean, it was Mark Crivelli who wrote about this on LouRockwell.com. He made a very good point. If we had a system like that, we'd be far better off. They were reactive. In other words, they're called to help when somebody has actually been on the receiving end of force or fraud. They investigate crimes and they apprehend suspects. That's pretty much all they should do. There was a study done, I'm engaging in a digression within a digression here, I recognize. In, I believe, 1974, it was in the early 1970s in Kansas City, it was carried out by the National Police Foundation, where they did a study of the value of routine patrol by police officers to find out what effect that had in the abatement of crime, defined here once again as crimes against property or crimes of violence. What they found out that there is no measurable benefit to routine patrol by police officers when it comes to dealing with crimes against person and property. That's been known now for about 40 years. So what purpose does routine patrol serve? Well, it serves the purpose of revenue collection primarily. But when you have routine patrol coupled with routine longstanding investigative task force activity, the purpose is to create crime rather than to solve crimes. And that's why we have this huge and metastasizing prison industrial complex. They feed people into this apparatus. They turn people into criminals, and then they turn criminals into profit centers, revenue streams for people who batten on this evil system. And that's why our purported land of the free has the largest prison population in human history. And the people who arranged the sting in upstate New York against Benjamin Wassel are trying to feed him into the machinery, first of all, because there's profit to be had, but secondly, they want to have him as the exemplary defendant. He's been charged with 3 felonies and a misdemeanor for conducting a perfectly innocuous sale of firearms that the state legislature had just banned, and ammunition that the legislature had just banned, that had been perfectly legal transactions 3 months ago. But he was released on his own recognizance. Now, that implicitly acknowledges that he's not an actual criminal, notwithstanding the defamatory comments by Joseph D'Amico that he's a dangerous criminal. And if they have their way in New York, this is the other part of the story that's really ominous, New York police officials will be having a bumper crop of cases of this sort because a year ago they established very quietly, not many people were paying attention to this, an anonymous tip line encouraging people to report suspected illegal gun owners for a $500 reward. Now, that was established a year ago, but since that Gun Confiscation Act, you have to call it confiscation, they're criminalizing possession of things that people already have. Since that was enacted by the state legislature, the state police now have made a point of publicizing this tip line. And in our environmentally straitened circumstances, or economically straitened circumstances, rather, there are going to be plenty of people in New York and elsewhere who will think that this is a potentially lucrative undertaking and that they would be able to justify this in the name of public service. I think my neighbor has illegal firearms. And so chances are that you're going to find a number of people in upstate New York primarily who are going to be railroaded into prosecution because they have been possessing a number of guns that were perfectly legal until recently, and their neighbors are going to be the ones who are going to turn against them. It's really biblical, if you will. Man's enemies are going to be those of his neighborhood, perhaps even those of his household. There's another case that was reported just a couple of days ago, matter of fact, just yesterday in Suffolk County, involving a man who may or may not be a disreputable fellow by the name of Jay Steiner, and he's been accused of having a stockpile of illegal weapons, 300 weapons, what was described as 85 illegally possessed handguns. He had been a federally licensed firearms dealer within the last decade or so, and for whatever reason, he ended up not renewing his license. And he has a misdemeanor offense on his record, but he's not a gangbanger. He's not a drug dealer. He's not somebody who's inclined toward criminal behavior. He just simply had a number of firearms that were running afoul of technical gun registration and licensing requirements. The district attorney for Suffolk County, Thomas Spota, said that, quite frankly, this fellow had more firepower than the detectives when they went to go search his house. He calls that horrifying. I call that inspiring. We're supposed to outgun the government. Go back to what James Madison said. This news report says that Steiner was arrested on January 25th after members of the DA's gun suppression team completed a search of his home. Gun suppression team is the name of this outfit. I had not seen the phrase gun suppression team. I've seen variants on the phrase crime suppression team, and most of these task forces are in the inner cities. They're focusing on street violence. They're focusing on street gangs. They're keeping an eye on suspected drug traffickers, and most of what they do doesn't involve the actual suppression of crime. They're simply syndicating it. They're making the profit opportunity for the government. But the point is, I've not seen the expression gun suppression team before. And if you look at some of the ATF literature, there are references to firearms suppression teams, but it's always in the context of inner city crime or urban crime. Well, this is moving into the suburbs now. It's starting in New York. It's probably going to be popping up in Colorado. In California, just within the last week, we've seen a story about how there are teams of police officers and multi-jurisdictional task forces with the ATF and DEA involved who are taking rosters of people who have documented psychological troubles in their history, people that have been involuntarily committed or undergone mental health treatment, and they're confiscating firearms from these people who don't have criminal records. And this is the other vector in this issue that I find really troubling, because there is this consensus on the part of the NRA, which is not a friend of gun ownership, in my opinion, and a number of so-called conservative commentators, that rather than focusing on gun ownership, we need to focus on mental health. That's what they're doing in California right now, and thousands or tens of thousands of people are having their firearms confiscated, and the government is supposedly revoking their right to armed self-defense, as if they could do that. The government doesn't have that authority, but they're pretending as if they can revoke their right to armed self-defense, not because they've committed crimes, but because they're seen as psychologically unstable. That's where this issue really is going to flourish, I think, is in the realm of mental health. That's, I think, one of the things that the Obamacare monstrosity is going to result in, going to be a much more invasive scrutiny of people's mental health, psychological health, with an eye toward disarming as many members of the public as possible. And, of course, another way to disarm people is simply to have the federal government buy up all the ammunition and make it otherwise inaccessible to the people in the public who are being targeted by these same federal law enforcement and security agencies. So we're really seeing things happening, coalescing at a terrifying rate, and we're seeing overt ugliness materialize in front of us in terms of this executive-dominated and increasingly militant homeland security apparatus, where any of us at any time can be deemed psychologically unsuitable or politically unreliable and find our rights being constricted or savagely curtailed, if not our very physical existence taken from us by way of an executive ordered assassination. That's the country we're living in right now. I want our old country back.
Well, I don't know they're ever going to see it back, William, but our job is to get the information out, to get people to think. How can people get in touch with you? What's your website? How can they reach you?
My chief outlet is freedominourtime.blogspot.com, the Pro Libertate blog. Pro Libertate is the name of the blog. William N. Grigg, Google William N. Grigg, Pro Libertate should be the first return. And at the bottom of every essay, I have a PayPal button for those who have access to PayPal and are interested in contributing to help me keep that blog up and running.
And, of course, we support William. I hope you will as well. WilliamGrigg.com, WilliamGrigg.com. Well, William, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up tonight's program.
Dr. Stan, I really do appreciate this opportunity, and it's a source of great comfort to me to know that I have the opportunity to speak with you, and I deeply respect you and appreciate everything you've done for these many decades on behalf of the truth. And I'm also comforted to know that you command a substantial, very large, and a very wonderful audience of people who share our concerns, see many of the same things that torment us. And these are things, of course, that cause sleep to become a stranger when my head hits the pillow every night, because I, like many other people in your audience, have children. I have a family. I have young children whose futures are being imperiled, if not stolen, from those who have usurped the role of the creator and have suppressed or destroyed the rule of law. And I think that while we lament what's been taken from us in terms of our heritage of ordered liberty and the prospects of material improvement and, of course, the freedom to live lives in compliance with our creator's mandate, we lament what's been taken from us. But the fact is that what is most important to us can never be taken from us. You know, our lives were given to us by an agency other than government. Our freedoms were invested in us by an agency superior to and anterior to human government. Those things that the government can take from us in terms of our physical existence are not theirs to take, and they can be restored once again by those who have given us life, who has given us life and given us freedom. Really, in a long-term perspective, looking at this from the perspective of somebody who understands eternity and understands that we're not merely matter in motion, our enemies really don't have the strong hand. And that's a perspective we're going to have to maintain, because things are going to get ugly in a hurry in this country, and we have to gird ourselves against that impending disaster.
I certainly agree with you, and of course I think that we have to make our preparations as best we can. We also have to recognize the spiritual component of what's going on today, because there is an active conspiracy against God. I believe the people on the other side realize that those will not be ruled by God, will be ruled by tyrants, and the tyrants don't want us to look to God, and I think, of course, the only thing that's going to see most of us through the very difficult times that lie ahead is having a personal relationship and a personal reliance upon our Lord Jesus Christ. And I'm sure you'd agree with that.
Yes, I do. I agree with it from the depth of my soul.
All right, I want you to hang on for just 1 minute more as we bring all of our stations back on. I want you to get your Sydney address out, or webpage, one more time. Well, I guess this evening has been William Grigg. William, one more time, I want you to get your webpage out so people will know how to get your writings. And, of course, if they'd like to help you, there is a PayPal button at the bottom of every page. Look, how can people reach you again?
Dr. Stan, I really appreciate that. Pro Libertate is the name of the blog. Pro is P-R-O, then L-I-B-E-R-T-A-T-E, Pro Libertate. Their direct address is Freedom in Our Time. One word, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. The PayPal button you mentioned is the bottom of every essay. And I also write for LewRockwell.com, L-E-W-Rockwell.com, quite frequently.
And, of course, he also writes for Radio Liberty, and you'll be getting the newsletter very soon. It'll be going out the next day or so. God bless you. William, we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you. God bless.
And bye-bye. And, ladies and gentlemen, if you're in a position to help William, please do. If you're not, then pray for him. It's just as you pray for Radio Liberty, because he's part of our team, and really, we really have a team. I don't know how many of you know that Cindy Joel Skousen was involved in a terrible plane accident just a little over a week ago. And if you go up on the Internet, you can actually go to Google and asked to see the pictures of the plane. I mean, the plane just suddenly broke in two. And why Joel Skousen wasn't killed in that plane wreck, I really have no idea. People who saw it were sure the plane flipped and it just broke in two. And Joel had a couple little scratches. I do believe that, of course, God was looking after him. I believe that God has certainly looked after some of our regulars. Barry Shamish had surgery this week, and fortunately he's doing very well. And those of you who have prayed for him, we do deeply appreciate it. And Barry will be back with us next week. But it was really miraculous the way he did, and suddenly he called me about 1:30 in the morning to say goodbye, and he was going into surgery very shortly. It was almost as if he didn't know whether he was going to come out of it, and I told him we'd have our listeners praying for him. We did, and the following day he'd had his surgery. He was doing fine, talking about going home. So we appreciate certainly your support for the various people we have with us regularly, guests. All good patriots, each one with a message. But we are involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And certainly if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. If you'd like to get our four CD sets on the supernatural, or our four CD set on the satanic crimes that are available, you need to understand really what's going on today from a prophetic point of view, and that's why we carry Pastor Billy Crone's DVD sets. There are five DVDs in each set, and there are actually five sets. It's called The Final Countdown, and we carry some of the other material, and you can find that on our website, or if you'd like a catalog, we'll send it to you. But we think Pastor Billy has a wonderful means of ability to transmit ideas, and his certainly series of sermons on the prophetic things that are unfolding today, and all you need to do is look around you to see God's hand in what's going on, because so much of what's going on doesn't make sense. We're heading into another conflict in the Middle East. We're doing everything we can to unite the Muslim world as an enemy, just as we did with the Nazis. Certainly we financed the Nazis before World War II and during World War II. And if you haven't actually read the book, America's Nazi Secret, or heard our four CD set entitled The War Against the Jews, The War Against the Jews, my interviews with John Loftus, who had a security clearance three levels above top secret, you need to get that. You need to get Dr. Dennis Cuddy's book, The Power Elite and the Secret Nazi Plan. You need to get Professor Sutton's book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. So that's America's Nazi Plan, The Power Elite and the Secret Nazi Plan, and then, of course, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. And then if you want to know what really happened to Adolf, well, you need to get the book, The Grey Wolf, because, of course, they've lied to us about what happened to Adolf Hitler. But then, of course, Adolf Hitler was financed primarily by people here in America. He was put in power, and then he was taken care of afterwards. And, of course, the book, Grey Wolf, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Please, please pray for Radio Liberty.
Beside her and guide her. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour Radio Show. Thank you for joining us, caring about your world. It is 22 March 2013. It is Friday. Mass panic in Cyprus. The banks are collapsing. The ATMs are running out of money. It is not a pretty place. Now, that's the good news. It is incredible what's happening around the world. And meanwhile, the Jody Arias trial continues in the United States. Well, we're actually going to spend a little bit of time talking about the Jody Arias trial, which most of you don't know anything about or care about, nor has anyone emailed me about. So I figure it would be a good topic. Welcome, Josh, to the Power Hour this morning.
Thank you for having me.
I know that you would have your say on the Jody Arias trial.
I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about.
Good. I want your opinion then, because
you're being educated.
You're the man on the street I want to hear from then. No, I'll tell you. I want to hear what people are thinking in a certain direction as to why this is getting thousands of hours of airtime. Because it is. It's beyond.